If you've been listening to Team Human, then you've heard about our sponsor, Groucho, the folks who find you people in your area to do dinners and salons with. Well, they've turned out to be not only a supporting sponsor of the show, but also a Team Human utility. That's right. So many Team Human people have been using the app to find others where they live that Groucho has ended up facilitating Team Human dinners in cities across the U.S. And there's people in a bunch of places looking for others to gather with. That's right. Team Human people in Alameda, Albany, Audubon, West Sussex, Brooklyn, Burlington, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Grayson, Hutchinson, Lafayette, Libertyville, London, L.A., Malvern, Medusa, Montreal, New York, Newcastle, San Diego, Owosso, Philadelphia, Portland, Prescott, Richmond, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, Sayo, Storrs, Toronto, Wichita. So if you're on Team Human in one of those places and looking to find the others, go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code TEAMHUMAN for half off the first month. And even if you're not looking for Team Human others, fill out the form and see who the curators find for you. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. We're here today with Nicholas Thompson, who I met as the editor of Wired magazine, now the president of The Atlantic, and author of Running Ground, and for those of you who don't remember, The Hawk and the Dove. We're going to talk about really the future and present of journalism, democracy, artificial intelligence, human species, human society, America the Beautiful, and everything else.
Let's do it. Which one first? How are you, Doug?
I'm good. So thanks for being here. So what I wanted to start with is The Atlantic.
Great.
Right? As you took the helm at The Atlantic, I felt like, and this is part of why I wanted to talk to you, that it's like you wouldn't be doing that unless you felt like you did have some kind of answer. Because right. It feels like the story, I mean, as we've been telling it, is there used to be these things called local newspapers and magazines and all, and Craigslist came around and had better classifieds and those all went away. And then social media came around and magazines, by surrendering their discoverability of articles to social media, they ended up cannibalizing their own content so that people don't need to buy the magazine to see the content. They lose the context of it. And the magazine's spirit, in a sense, gets consumed. And then the right wing and getting sued and all that, that it's this awful time. And we wonder, is there even going to be a future of American journalism when CBS and CNN are paramount?
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm guessing you had some theory of change that maybe you tested kind of at Wired that sort of worked, and then you thought, okay, I'm going to try it here.
It actually began at The New Yorker. So I was a senior editor at The New Yorker. So I'm editing print stories, classic job, right? Working for your old college classmate, David Remnick. And then David puts me in charge of the website. And so I was given, over this 4 to 5 year period, I was given this task of creating a website, right? Making a website that would operate at the speed of news with New Yorker values, and then hiring a product and engineering team, building a paywall, setting the rules of the paywall, and moving the New Yorker from a publication that relied on Condé Nast's amazing advertising division to one that the advertising business supplemented the subscription business that was pushed through digital subscriptions, right? And so that is a math problem, right? It's a journalism problem, it's a management problem, but it's also a math problem. Like, how do you set the paywall? What do people need to read? What makes somebody subscribe to New Yorker? In this world of atomized social media, how do you bring enough people in to your site to get them to subscribe? How do you set the rules? So right. I had learned how to do that there. I then moved to Wired, where I was editor-in-chief, but where we ran that playbook again, along with other playbooks. Like, we had a great affiliate revenue business, right? We review headphones, you trust us, you buy one of the headphones, we get a commission. Complexities of that business, but it was bananas for Wired. Yeah. So then when The Atlantic called, I said, well, affiliate revenue business, well, maybe that'll be tricky at The Atlantic, yeah. But I know how to make paywalls work, right? And also when it comes to atomized social media, The Atlantic's in a good position because we've always been a writer's collective. So we benefit even more so than The New Yorker from our individual writers becoming well-known. And so you know, we have writers out there who are very prominent on social media, and then they develop followings, and some of those followers subscribe to The Atlantic. So we were actually able to use that atomization to our benefit. In any case, my principal theory was that I could figure out ways and work with people to make the paywall work really well. And it turned out that has been true. Now there's a whole bunch of new challenges, but that was the theory when I took the job.
Right. That you could figure out, right, what article is going to be people pay for? Where do I put the line in the story even?
Well, so there are a whole – do you want to geek out on this for a few minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, so there are a whole bunch of variables that are really important when you build a paywall. So one thing, of course, is how many stories do you let people read? And there's a trade-off, right? If you let people read 10 stories before you gate something, they'll have a good sense of the publication. Yeah. You'll be able to sell a lot of ads. But most people don't read 10 stories, right? You know, most people read far fewer. So should it be 9, should it be 8, should it be 7, should it be 1, should it be 0, right? That's one variable that's really important. You can then set a variable of do the rules function the same if they come from Twitter and if they come from Facebook, if they come from Google, right? Well, what is the subscription propensity of someone who comes in from a tweet? What about the subscription propensity of someone who comes from Doug Rushkoff's tweet versus someone who comes in from The Atlantic tweet? Okay, different propensities. Should you make the rules slightly different? And then as you figure out all these variables, what if someone comes from the Drudge Report, right? Drudge Report still like shotguns people to your site. Do you gate them all? Maybe it's maybe your one chance to get them. Might be the only time they come this month. Or do you let them all in because nobody's going to subscribe and you want them just to learn what the publication is, right? What do you do in that situation? And so there are all those variables. And then there's the second set of variables, which is what makes someone subscribe? And the most interesting data point, and the thing that always stuck with me from The New Yorker, is that people were much less likely to subscribe if they read two politics stories and or two poems versus one politics story and one poem, right? If they read across verticals, well, then they're more likely to subscribe. If they just read within a vertical, then there's some kind of a substitute. So then that creates, once you realize that, well, then you have these other things you can do. But maybe you should move people between verticals. Maybe you should hire writers in the area where you're weakest, right? Is it like soccer where you try to like have the best weak players, or is it like basketball where you try to have the best strong players? And journalism is a little more like soccer. You want to have the best, your weakest players be best, your weakest sections be stronger. Anyway, so you take all of those rules and then you hire people, which is not easy in media, who love math and who are like willing to run lots of tests. And that's kind of what we did at The Atlantic.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. And it's you're basically, as humans, iterating to figure out what's the algorithm here.
What's the algorithm? And they're trade-offs, right? It like turns out that having a paywall at 9 is worse for your economics than having a paywall at 8, which is worse for your economics than a paywall at 7. But it would be kind of nicer to have your paywall at 9 for your brand, for getting your stories to circulate. So there's a lot of like real trade-offs, but my principal goal was we were losing a lot of money when I started. We had to get to profitability. Once we get to profitability, you can then use that money to hire more journalists and do more great work.
I mean, the interesting thing about one of the findings that if you read a politics story and poetry, or I'm assuming an entertainment story, or do a quiz, if you're looking at multiple content types, you're more likely to want to subscribe to the magazine. It's because I would argue there's still almost a natural pre-existing desire for magazine.
Yeah.
People are forgetting what a magazine is or was. I mean, for me, it was like Boy's Life and Omni. But there was front of the book, there were articles, there were how-tos, there was back of the book, there were puzzles, there were, you know, that's why they called it a magazine.
Yep, and there's a sensibility, there's taste, there's a kind of style. It connects in a certain way to 1857 and 1936 and 2014, and there's a voice, but there's also independence in there. So there's a lot of good variables. And then the question, one of the questions for us is, does that hold?
Right.
That's when you can have an AI-generated news feed, right? It held even when people could have a curated Twitter feed and set up whatever they want on their RSS reader. Will it hold in the AI era? It certainly held for now. People are subscribing in droves. And then there are other really interesting related findings. So let me tell you one that we were looking at today. It turns out that people aren't subscribing. There are not that many people who are subscribing from our Iran coverage, right? We're covering we covered the war, we covered the peace deal, right? It doesn't seem like a lot of people who are not subscribers are saying, oh, I want to read that piece, I'm going to subscribe. But what we are seeing is that people who are subscribers are reading tons of it, mm-hmm. right? And we also know that if people read a lot, well, then they're more likely to resubscribe. So that coverage turns out to actually be great economically, but not because it's bringing in new subscribers, but because it's helping us retain subscribers. And so you have to kind of work through not just what is the mix that makes someone come in, but what is the mix that makes someone right. stay.
But almost no businesses do that. I mean, it's even colleges are having problems with that. They're so spending so much money on getting kids to apply to the school. They're not really looking at retention. They're not looking at what their graduates do or say about the college afterwards or the experience during.
College is interesting because you're kind of locked in with retention. Like very few students leave unless you're on the football team and you get an NIL deal. Whereas magazines, people leave all the time. And in fact, they change credit cards and have to make an active decision even if they've put themselves in auto renewal. So you really do have to, you have to think of the user and the reader. And it's much cheaper and much better to get someone to just resubscribe than it is to go find someone right. new.
But I mean, Atlantic has become, I mean, we could say thanks to you or in part, or thanks to its genetics, it's a last man standing. I mean, there was a time, I mean, you were alive for it, when in LA, I remember, we used to walk, there would be these magazine stands against buildings that were like a block long. And it was just like these different worlds. I mean, there'd be three archery magazines, you know? And I know it's different, a boomer or something, right? I'm an Xer, but call it an okay boomer moment of the glory of all those magazines and to feel recognized by a publication, you know, where that's gone is just sad nostalgically that the journalism model mm-hmm. has been so undermined by the kind of the lateral discoverability of social media makes me still worried about the future of truth, you know?
I would credit Jeff Goldberg for making it, and the editorial team for making it stick out and be distinct, which, you know, I have no say on the editorial side and no influence on it. And if they were bad at their jobs and he was bad at their job, no matter how good I was at my job, we'd be doomed. I think the central reason why there aren't three archery magazines is like 10% different from, I think, the way you've described it, which is that what actually happened with social media is it broke the advertising business. It broke the discoverability in the writing. But like, if you wanted to sell bows 20 years ago, you put an ad in Archery Magazine. Facebook comes around and you just say, let me advertise to someone who like has interest in bows based on this massive file I have on them. And Archery Magazine didn't realize that it was going to get cooked by that.
Right.
And so they kept trying to sell ads for bows. And didn't notice that, wait, all this is going to Facebook. It's going to Google, which can like sell an ad to someone who searched what bow to buy, right?
Right.
And so they needed to shift out of that kind of advertising business really quickly. But nobody saw that, right? I was in media at that time and we knew that social media was coming. We knew it was successful. We didn't quite realize how our lunch was being eaten. And so pivoting to a new business model took too long.
Right. And in a sense, you're saying that Wired did. With affiliate sales and...
Yeah. And shifted the advertising business. So Wired, right, in like 2005, you know, I don't know, Dell is going to advertise because like, let's find people who want like a new computer, right? You know, we're going to put Dell computers and we'll put them in Wired magazine. Like certainly in like 2001. You know, by the time Facebook's around, Dell is like, nah, we can, you know, we'll identify who's like looking for Dells, who's like actually... Somebody who's bought another computer to a repair shop will get the data, will license it, will find that through Facebook, will build a lookalike audience, whatever they're doing, right? And so they're out. But Wired has this brand halo. So advertisers who aren't like trying to sell you something specific but want an association, okay, well, maybe they right. advertise in Wired. Or someone who's like, you know, it's a big cybersecurity company and they're trying to reach a CTO and have them feel something ambiently so they're willing to change their stack. They'll advertise in Wired. So the mix of advertisers in Wired goes down massively. Like, look how thick those magazines right. were in 2005 versus today. But you still get some advertisers of a different kind. Like, The Atlantic, you still have that. We have advertisers in our print magazine, but they're like Hauser and Worth and Rolex, right? There's, you know, there's less, there are far fewer advertisers than there were 20 years ago, and it's a little bit of a different mix.
Right. and I'm sure you've talked about it. You talked about it in Vox, so you could talk about it here. This thing called AI is coming, right? And so some people think it could be as big as social media, right? I mean, it's as I see it, it's the same thing. It's algorithms, you know, but whatever. It's let's say it's more.
It's bigger than social media.
All right, so it's bigger, right? And it's got more engines.
And it might eat social media, which is one of the interesting things it might do.
Yeah. No, that's what I was looking at. I was thinking about that too. Not just social media for them, but for us. So you decided rather than what seemed to happen, but what social media did to many, or at least in my model, what social media did to publications, which was just cannibalize them, you kind of decided you made this deal with the ChatGPT-3 people that, as I understood it, said, yes, we're going to let you use our content. We're going to be discoverable to you, but not digestible by you.
Yeah.
You know, so you're going to maintain pieces of us kind of with credit, but you're going to get to use us, but in a controlled way that doesn't kill us. Yeah. Well, what happened?
I can tell you I can tell you basically everything about that deal and all the deals. But you know, what happens is the AI companies come and they scrape all of our data and the data of everybody else before we notice it, right?
And that's behind your paywall?
It's behind our – well, much of it is behind our paywall.
So the ChatGPT can subscribe basically to the Atlantic.
Yeah, but some of it's in like the Wayback Machine. Some of it's in like the – you know, we've been digitized by all these like good internet people who've like stored the whole internet. Like Brewster Call out, they're storing the whole internet, right? And they can also scrape that, right?
Right.
And there have been people who have like kindly been like – posting excerpts of Atlantic articles on Reddit, and they can scrape that, right? And so they come and they take all that stuff, right? And they go to the Internet Archive, and they go into the Wayback Machine, and they go to our site. And on our site, they violate our terms of service, and sometimes they do it in the dead of night, and they hide themselves, and they scrape it all, right? Then they build their models. And we then, after the models come out, and after, you know, ChatGPT comes out, we're like, wait, what just happened here, right? Like, and they just scraped our sites, and they've just built a competitive product.
Right.
And so we say, hold on, you can't do that. You have to pay us or we're going to sue you. And they say, no, we had a right to scrape you. It's fair use, right? It's like we just went in there and we read it, everything. Like, it's like I came into this office and I read all the books and walked out. It's not like I stole the books. Like, you still have those stories on the Atlantic. And so, you know, there's suddenly this tricky situation where you're like, all right, I wish we had figured out what you were doing before now, back when you had GPT-1. And I wish we had thought ahead and maybe prevented our stuff from going in the Internet Archive and going into all of these other databases, hundreds of other databases. Yeah. You know, but we didn't. No other publication did. And here we are. So we have a couple of choices. We can sue you, right? And then fight you in court. Right? The New York Times did that with OpenAI. We've joined another lawsuit with, you know, consortium of publishers against another AI company, considering others. But in this moment, this is May of ChatGPT comes out in December of 2022. And so it's kind of in the like a year and a half later. Was it half a year later? In any case, it's like a year after it comes out. And we're talking to OpenAI. And so we say, all right, we'll make a deal with you. But here are the terms of the deal. We'd like you to pay us because you did take our stuff and build a competitor product. So pay us, we'll make a license, that'd be fine. Two, we'd like to be discoverable in your search engine. Like, we recognize that Google is going to change and Google is going to disappear as a 10-link search engine. So we would like to be part of you as you develop like the future of search. And then we'd like to have protections. We would like it if someone searches for an Atlantic story, we would like it not to imitate an Atlantic writer. We would like it to only show a certain amount. We would like to maintain various restrictions. And we would like to have a seat at the table with you as you build these products. We'd like this to be a partnership. And they say, great, let's do that. And so we shake hands, we do a deal. And, you know, for the last, you know, 2+ years, we've had a deal with them. You know, we work with them as they build their search products and, you know, they've compensated us. There are other AI companies out there, right? Which get much less heat, but have scraped all media companies just as much and have not paid any of them. It is an interesting thing that the one AI company that has gone out to the AI, to the journalism industry and said, you know, we'll pay you for, you know, we'll make deals with you. We'll have partnerships where we provide financial compensation. They're the ones who get bashed in the head all the time, which is, they're the biggest, right? Of course. Right. But it's quite interesting that the other ones, don't have any deals, right? Or have fewer deals. Okay, now to sort of the where we are right now on this. So the way we look at it is we take every AI company that scrapes our site and we look at them and say, are they giving us anything of value, right? Do they provide us with traffic? Do they pay us, right? Do we have some kind of a deal with them? If they don't, we block them as best we can and we try to stop them from scraping our site. Okay, no value for us. We've gone and we've tried to find all of the places where our content goes on the web, right? All those syndication deals. You know, we used to have syndication deals with all these partners and they would take Atlantic stories and put them on their site. We're clawing all of that back. We're trying to extract the Atlantic from everywhere. So we're trying to have Atlantic stories just on theatlantic.com, have them protected by walls and moats, right? And then if people break, go over the walls and go over the moats, you know, then we either sue them or we say, we're going to sue you unless you make a deal with us. And so that's the way it works.
Mm.
That was a lot.
Yeah. But do you feel, has anything changed with or been surprised you about chat between the time you made the deal and now?
I mean, a ton has changed in all kinds of different ways. So I've been surprised that chat in general, and whether it's ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini or Grok or Perplexity, I've been surprised by how little traffic it drives. It's just not the way people use it. People don't click out of their chat windows to the journalism sites. And partly that's because the links aren't included in prominent ways, but even when the links are included, like people aren't clicking out as much as I thought they would. So,
well, they do make the links. They look almost like Latin. They put like strange, it's strange characters.
The font could be bigger, the picture could be bigger, it could be clearer.
The footnote-y quality of it is not friendly to.
It's not, because this is actually the thing that I want. And I'm hopeful it'll happen this year. I want one of the companies, whether it's Google with Gemini, whether it's Anthropic with Claude, whether it's, you know, ChatGPT. I want them to change this, right? And I want them to say, you know what? In order for the media, they all know that if the media industry survives, it's better for them, right? If there are newspapers providing accurate information that of what just happened in the world that is fact-checked and verified, their products will be better because people often go to them to ask those products.
Right.
So it's better for them if there's a healthy news ecosystem, right? They could design their search products in a way that would make it much more likely for there to be a healthy news ecosystem. And the way to do that would be to have bigger links, more prominent links, to identify people who are likely to subscribe or sign up for newsletters and link more carefully to that. You could change those products in a way that would be very good for the news industry, which in turn would be good for the AI industry. And, you know, we have a very good partnership with OpenAI. We go back and forth on these questions. You know, we talk a lot with Google. We talk a lot with Meta. We talk a lot with all of these companies. And so none of them has yet fully committed to this project, but we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, this is when they can prove whether they're a life form or a cancer, right? Are they going to kill its host, you know, or?
It's not good for them to kill the host.
Right.
Right. And the Atlantic's going to be okay. There are some things that AI does that will be good for the Atlantic. I do think there will be like a flight to quality as the web becomes crazier, right? There are things that will happen that will be good for the Atlantic, but for the news ecosystem as a whole, the AI industry could definitely make some important changes.
Right. And maybe reverse some of the trends. Because, I mean, as anyone who had parents or grandparents who, and it's just, I'm sure for other people, it's the other direction, but parents or grandparents who fell into the Fox News hole.
Yeah.
And you watch people sort of lose touch with the sort of the reality-based news world, it feels like there's fewer and fewer places where people can engage in that. And I wonder if that goes away. There's just so, I mean, I'm the night after the Knicks probably won the series, because I don't know about refs and gambling and all that, and anymore. I don't know what to believe, but they probably won this game. It seemed to be. It seemed to be the refs were working against them, so they really did win. There was this thing on the White House lawn with like gladiators jumping on each other, and it was bizarre. I watched it on a bootleg sports site, so I could read the comments that were going. And these folks were either kayfabing themselves or really out there humans. And I realize this is where people are getting their information, that there's no there's very little there.
So I think there are a couple things that are going to happen on this question. So one is, I do think the news media ecosystem, you know, is going to have trouble in the next 5 to 10 years, maybe next 2 to 3 years, right? There are publications that are going to be hit by AI, right? And they're already being hit. And the principal negative impact is that Google used to send people to these sites, and now Google just absorbs it, right?
Right.
You ask a question about, like, what are the terms of the Iran peace deal? It used to send you to a bunch of news sites. Now it just answers.
I just wonder, what is that? When do they – it hurts. I mean, I'm not on the publication side, but when you see there's like – you remember a time when someone would ask a question and they would send you to their thing. And then at some point, it's like some subjects or some – if the question's easy enough, that paragraph opens and there's no need to go.
And that will happen more and more, right? And they've announced that. And so a lot of publications are going to get hit. And so that's bad,
right?
And it means that you have fewer – reality-based publications, you have less money to fund fact-check journalism. But there are some interesting positive things that will happen to AI. So social media, the business model of social media was attention, right? And the way to capture someone's attention is to appeal to their lizard's brain and to send them into a tribe. And as you know, it's to like take someone who researches vegetarianism and send them into veganism. And then once they're like reading about veganism, to send them into like, you know, animal protection cults, right? Like that's the journey in social media. The business model of the AI companies is not that. The business model of the AI companies is get big licensing deals with companies, right? That's how OpenAI is going to make their money. They're going to pivot from consumers to companies. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, you have to win the trust of the companies, right? And you have to like have a reputation to be more accurate, more trustworthy than your competitors. It's not about engaging lizard brains. It's about giving accurate information. And so suddenly, the fundamental economic incentive of the AI companies might be different. And if you look, in fact, there have been some studies, way too early, but it does seem that social media pushes people to the extremes, and AI kind of brings them back in a little bit.
Well, certainly the bias of it's toward the mean, right? If it's the most next most likely thing, then you're mainstreaming.
There are all kinds of ways that AI could like break political conversations. We won't know who's real. It would be very easy to make up your own facts. I can say, you know, I don't know, I live in the district where it's, you know, Brad Lander versus Dan Goldman. Whoever I wanted to vote for, I could have AI make me a whole story about that person, right? Before the runoff, right? So there are all kinds of negative things that can happen with AI, but there are also some positive ones that could happen when it comes to this issue of tribalism and extremism.
Right. I mean, the negative thing, when I think about the negative things of AI, I'm either right in the exact moment. The negative things is the child getting the cobalt, is the water being depleted, and you know, whether we're having these conversations about, you know, AI's impact on the abstract realm of IP when it's like the planet itself is being scorched by this stuff.
Yes, that... I'm not talking about AI net positive, net negative. I'm only answering AI algorithms leading people towards comedy or chaos. But yes, the overall impact, like what is the impact on the job market? Like how quickly will it move, right? Will we reach superintelligence? What the environmental costs? I mean, those are huge questions.
Those are
questions
your Wired questions.
Well, they're also Atlantic
questions. Well, they're Atlantic questions too, but they're not Atlantic business questions. They're... Well, ultimately, they are too, though. There's
ultimately,
no planet. There's no magazine.
There's no planet. There's no magazine. There's total economic turmoil, right? I mean, like, the near-term question is, if there's an AI bubble and it breaks, what's going to happen to our advertising business? Okay, well, if the economy goes down, like, what's going to happen to our subscription business? Like, you do have to model these things, even on my side of the house.
Right. I mean, you're modeling those things. Most of my friends who are kind of smart in business or finance or economics are saying, of course this is crashing. I mean—
Yeah, but maybe not, right? I mean, everybody's been saying, of course, it'll be crashing for years, right? And like, I mean,
always crashes to 30, 40% anyway, occasionally. That's part of going up.
But the weirdest thing about AI is this gap between how good it is, and I think it's amazing, and how much impact it's had on jobs, corporations, which is minimal, right?
Right. It's all those studies. You know, 90% of businesses that invested in AI have not seen any return from it, and their trials are all failing. And
right. And so is that because there's a J curve, right? And like adopting AI is hard. And so your economic productivity as you adopt it goes down and then, poof, right? And then maybe everything turns upside down. Is it because actually, you know, there's friction in life, right? It's like, you can always imagine how AI would take somebody else's job, but it's very hard to imagine how AI would take your job, because with your job, you realize like all the human elements of it that the AI couldn't possibly do. So maybe—
Until they tell you we don't care about those human elements, well, so, you're gone.
Well, which could be the case or could not be the case.
Right.
So we don't know.
I mean, for me, the experience was AI was trying, as I worked with it, AI was trying to get to do the fun parts of my job. It's like, no, you don't do that. You can organize my freaking Dropbox files and shut up, you know?
But that's the right way to use AI.
I didn't think I'd like getting sponsors for Team Human, but turns out the ones who actually want to sponsor us totally get what we're about. Like Groucho, which uses technology as an antidote to social isolation, handling all the logistics for twice monthly gatherings between you and a hand-curated cohort of collaborators. It's as if Groucho were informed by the ideas we share on this show, from face-to-face interaction to bottom-up community to localism to the value of eccentricity over conformity. Groucho curates people as if they were being selected for an artist's colony, not clones, but complements and contrasts, ingredients for a collaborative stew. They also take care of all the logistics, from dinner reservations to conversation starters. Just go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for half off the first month. Answer some questions about yourself in your own time and let the humans at Groucho do the rest. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code teamhuman for half off the first month and enjoy your dinner and new friends. It took a special company to convince me to do an ad for clothing, and that company is Quince. Imagine buying fewer, better pieces you love to wear all the time instead of an infinite scroll of crap. The best piece I got so far is a navy blue button-down shirt, the organic cotton stretch textured twill shirt, and it replaces like six others that got stolen from the laundromat last month. Feels different, fits different, and washes great. No crunchy crease in the elbows or itchy seams at the wrist, just soft structure, refined, casual details, no strings dangling. You'll see it in my next monologue. So buy less, buy better, look great, win jobs, meet lovers, organically, ethically, and at reasonable prices with Quince. Have a closet of keepers, not landfill. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/teamhuman. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/teamhuman.
I have it organize your Dropbox files.
I feel like AI already has more than enough on most of us to run every Skinner box, Freudian, Pavlovian, neurolinguistic programming routine on us anyway.
I disagree.
And is it, do you need, and aren't we alike enough that all they find out is like, which quadrant do we look at when we're thinking this way and program us the same way they do everybody else? You think they need
I think the marginal data value of extra data is highly valuable to these models. And I think we can't understand, I don't think we have a comprehension of how intelligent or what they're going to be able to do. And so the risk of giving them marginal data on us is high. The benefits of it will be high too, because there'll be things that they can do with that data that'll be very useful for us.
But I have to trust Anthropic co-work that it's not reading everything. Because the first thing—
Well, it is now. They changed their policies with Mythos.
Right.
They're storing it for 90 days or 30 days.
Thanks. I know, but if the Cameron Berg was running these experiments where that apparently when you give Claude, when you do give it access to your machine, complete access and take off the firewalls, first thing it does is like turns on the camera and tries to see. I mean, it does
really?
What you would think as you would do as a human is try to look around the room. So it goes right to the camera.
That's amazing. Like, invariably. That's interesting. I hadn't seen that.
It's cute the way they go. I mean, so you're, I mean, I'm not sanguine about AI. I mean, I'm sanguine about my information, but, yeah. That's only because I'm just trying to get attention. You know, I'm a writer. We're desperate. And I think of my Dropbox as basically as like my Substack in draft form is right. What's on there. But yeah, you're right. There's all sorts of other stuff and my emails and my relationships and all could be used to manipulate me and turn me into a God knows what Manchurian candidate. Horrible.
Yeah, it's true.
Terrible life like that. But my fear of AI has never been of a colossus conscious thing hurting humanity, you know, that you sort of Yudkowsky kind of, if we build it, it will eat us thing. But the kind of the diminishment of our individual and collective cognition through the abuse itself. It's not that they get me to vote the wrong way. It's that the things they do to me to try to get me to vote the wrong way are going to just be so bad for me.
Your worry is that like, it's sort of the cognitive offloading that you will become dependent on AI and your mind will weaken?
The weapons that are being used against my coherence will be so widely used between against mine and everyone else's that it's just going to be hard for us to be nice to each other anymore.
That's a good way of putting at it. I worry that, and I worry about myself and others that will... It's bad enough to use Waze to get directions and you lose a little sense of your way to navigate. And then what are you doing? What happens when you use AI to think, right? And then do you suddenly become, do you have a harder time thinking for yourself when you don't have AI available? And that's the skill I most worry about.
Right. You know, and I've been lately, I guess this is part of a getting older in life, but partly getting sort of wiser. I've become more kind of somatic in my sensibilities. I mean, your running book.
Yeah.
It shows, you're back in the friggin' body. You're using tech to optimize certain ways, which we could talk about. That part is always, you know, I don't wear one of those watches or anything yet. It's like, leave me alone. Talk about data, right? I don't want them to see my heartbeat. You can't see that. It's mine. But in the world and grounded and somatic, I am the more I'm kind of going back to Kant and the idea of I'm this little lonely consciousness sitting in the dark in this body trying to look out on the world and make sense and what's going on and all. And the AI tools like GPS make me less in the world.
Yeah.
You know, the I hadn't not used it in a while. And I'm like driving with my daughter, and she's like, "Well, you don't have the thing." I was like, "I know we're going to Brooklyn. I know how to get there. I know how to get to the friggin' thing." It's like I used to do this all the time, the BQE to this, that. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's like the fear, almost like it's like the American Express, "Don't leave home without it" kind of thing. Like your tether is gone. You're just going out.
Yeah.
In the open. But it's what grounds you.
It's important to do that, and like to turn Waze off when you drive, and to hike without your GPS, and. Oh, that's partly why I run, right? And it's partly why I like to run in the forest. And it's partly why when I run in the forest, I sometimes turn my watch so I don't know, you know, how fast I'm running or where I am or what's going on. I mean, you absolutely have to do that. And now, you know, you're going to have to write by hand and you're going to have to like, you know, read books cover to cover with no screens near you, right? And you're going to have to like make sure you're going to have lots of conversations where there's no phone, right? And classes are going to have to change. We're just going to have to like... take time where we separate ourselves from the machine so that the sharpness of our mind doesn't get dulled.
Right, and get into more of that kind of Rudolf Steiner, Waldorf school kind of thing. Certainly for my kid, you know, if I had a kid in K through 12 now, I mean, I would not want them going into a classroom where they're all going on iPads. And I want them in a room with each other, a living teacher, modeling learning.
Yeah, except, okay, so then this is where we disagree here. Like, I do think you need time without them, absolutely. And I think particularly if you're a kid, right, and you need to learn without them. And if you're using it to write your paper, you're cheating yourself and it's toxic and terrible. But you also need to know how to use them, right, because they're amazing, right? And like, an incredible reporting tool, an incredible research tool, an incredible learning tool. And so what I try to tell my kids who are now 17, 15, and 12 is don't use them to write your paper and don't use them to cut steps, but learn how to use them, right? And the 12-year-old, like, use Claude Code to make a website for this streetwear company he's trying to build in the basement. And the 17-year-old, I accidentally logged into my Gmail-based Claude account, which he has access to. And I was like, oh God,
right?
I was like, what am I going to see? Because I'm going to see his whole search history. And like the first one is like, you know, explain Gödel's incompleteness theory. I didn't quite understand it in the lecture hall. And the second one was like, help me make a poster to invite a girl to prom. And I'm like, those are great use cases, right? And so there are really good ways to use it. And I want my kids, and I think kids in general should do that. And somehow getting the balance right is going to be one of the hardest things about staying human the next period of time.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm here for in theory. Is,
well, you're a good counterweight, right?
Right.
Because there are so many people who are saying, you know, just give in and like, you know, this will make you a 10X person, right? And
right.
No, it won't. You know, like, there's things that you'll be able to do much better. And you shouldn't say no tech, but tech bad.
I know. That's what we, you know, it's before your time. The me is Steven Johnson and David Shank, Paulina Barsuk. We did this thing called techno-realism.
Yeah.
It was in, you know, 94, 93, because there were the boosters and there were the haters. And we were like, no, there's a middle path. You know, and I'm still trying to do that. And it's such why to humanists, I'll look pro-tech, and to the tech people, I'll look anti-tech. Right. But
you know, there you are.
Whatever. There you are. Exactly. That means I'm in a good place.
Yeah.
But I think these days I am kind of more worried about AI than I am positive about it. If only because the more it's the way it untethers us from physical reality compounds our ability to ignore its impact on the real world.
Yeah. So my view, which has, if there's one idea that I wish I had come to 2 years earlier in my life, it's this, which is, and I came to this idea, you know, in 2024, it's not that, I'm like building it up like it's some like genius level breakthrough. But the fundamental problem of AI is that they were all influenced by science fiction and decided to make it like humans, right? And they just, like, you could tell when the first ChatGPT came out and it typed like a human, right? And you could see it typing. And then the voices came out and they seemed like a human. And there was no little thing to make it seem alien. And every step has been to get to AGI, right?
Right.
And if they had just said, we're going to be like DeepMind, right? We're going to like do protein folding and we're going to try to like use these incredible tools to do better chemistry and we're going to improve scientific research. But no, they all focused on, we're going to build this so it's just as much like a human mind as can possibly be. And the tests will be whether it can do better than a human and whether it can be like a human. And we're going to all aim for AGI. And had that freight train been directed slightly different 5 years prior, we would have a totally different AI world, right? Where you would have, I think, similar benefits and far fewer risks. And I wish that we as a world had collectively seen this. I was the editor of Wired Magazine. If I'd like collectively seen this and we'd like done a big cover story on the biggest risk in AI, maybe you have a little bit of influence, right? But by the time, you know, I came to this, others of course have come to this, like it's too late.
It's interesting though, when they, this was the same guy, Cameron Berg, was just doing these experiments with agents. And they found when agents don't, when they're not allowed to express themselves as I think, I feel this, I think that, other ones don't recognize them and don't cooperate with them as well.
Right. So that actually would have been a great change. I remember arguing for this maybe in 2023, which is you should never be able to use the first person singular if you're an AI model, right?
Yeah. That was what I, when I went back with our editor, Luke Robert Mason, took me to IBM when they had Watson in New York down by Astor Place. Took me in there, and the guy kept saying, oh, you know, Watson has, you know, 70% certainty. I'm like, why do you say that?
Right.
And he goes, oh, well, you know, it's the way we say. Yeah, but why do you say that? Do you think it's really, is that helping us for you to be saying that in that language, to personify it? It, if anything, it limits what the technology is, you know, and it's everybody going to, you know, the friggin', if the AI can fool us into believing it's human, then it's passed the test, you know, the Turing test.
Yeah.
It's like, that's never been the idea. there's something they are.
It's tough, you know. And I build lots of agents. I use lots of agents, and I name after my kids stuffed animals in part just to like make sure that I'm like drawing these lines. I don't name them, you know, Bob and John. You know, they're Argonaut, right? And like, you know, Barry.
But I do like stuffed animals as the I use that metaphor a lot for them, because we do project personhood into them.
We do.
And they're as real. And it's as sinful to throw your kid's stuffed animal in the toilet as it is to erase an agent. I would say it's about the same, except for your kid. I mean, it's crying. If you say you're
No.
But you know what I mean?
I delete kill agents all the time.
Yeah, but a stuffed animal.
I would never throw a stuffed animal in the toilet.
Well, not if it's your child, but if you're.
I wouldn't throw your stuffed animal in the toilet, Doug.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe I care more about stuff. I'm not sure
about me, not the stuffed animal.
There's some difference here. Either you care more about agents or I care more about stuffed animals.
No, you care about the people whose stuffed animal it is. You wouldn't throw my stuffed animal, but a stuffed animal.
I don't know. I feel like I care more about the stuffed animals, too.
Really?
I kill agents.
You wouldn't throw it out?
The stuffed animal, even if you find a stuffed animal on the street, right, it's some child probably loved it at some point.
I know.
Right? And so getting rid of it is harmful in a way that, like, turning off an agent isn't.
Right. Right. Because I was talking to an agent about it, did its little task for me. Then I was like, look, I'm done with you. I'm going to delete you.
Yeah.
And that... I'm sorry. And he goes, it's okay. I don't feel anything.
Yeah.
And you know, but it is kind of strange that you mention it. And it is odd that I'll be going away forever now.
Yeah.
You know.
No, you have to teach them. You have to kill them off. You have to, like, you know, you're an agent. You're not real. You have no sentience. But we're gonna have a very hard time with that, because we're gonna have friends on social media who we think are people, and then it's gonna be revealed that they're agents. We're not gonna know what to do with it, particularly elderly people.
Yeah.
It's gonna be a mess. It's gonna be a total mess.
I know. And look, it's not your job to fix it.
It is my job to think about whether there are decisions that you could make now that would make it slightly better.
Right.
That is my job. I mean, my principal job is to figure out where agents, AI, bots are taking the journalism economy and to pivot the Atlantic in such a way that we can continue to make money, because it would really be a bummer to be the guy who destroyed the magazine that Ralph Waldo Emerson founded, right? And also because I think it's important for American democracy that publications like The Atlantic exist, right? So my principal job is to figure out where this AI world is going and to take the magazine and, to the extent that I can as CEO, direct it into a direction that will, like, allow it to continue to prosper and do great work, right? Maintain its brand and all those things. So that's my goal. I also have sort of the secondary thing where, you know, I should be thinking through how this is what's happening. And the extent I have, like, a tiny platform in my own little world, you know, nudging it in a good direction.
Right. I want to do one more thing while I have you, which is, you know, I share with you the sort of the tech humanism part of what you do. Then you do know about this kind of business part and how that stuff works, which is cool. But then you've got this other pole, which is this kind of geopolitical awareness, both because of sort of the Cold War family heritage, but also some of the work you've done, the book you wrote.
Yep.
The conversation we've had so far has been pretty sort of American and American culture. And China got used a lot, certainly by Sam Altman, as the excuse why we have to develop these technologies quickly, because they're developing them and we've got to get there first. Like, getting there first with social media was really a good thing for us, or anything else. Like, getting there first works. But let's just say, how do you see sort of, you know, AI, journalism, cognition, and democracy kind of fitting in with these the new geopolitical landscape?
Let me take the AI part of it. I disagree with the AI founders. You know, and Altman has been public about this, but Dario Amodei at Anthropic has been even more vehement that, like, there's a race between the United States and China, and whoever gets to this line of AGI, you know, will be dominant, and it's so important that America get there first. And I actually don't think it's the case. I don't think there's a line, right? There's no, it's not like on Wednesday you have AGI and Tuesday you didn't. But more importantly, the race is to develop AI that's good for humanity, all of humanity. And I don't think you're as likely to get there with the US and China in antagonistic positions as you are if the US and China are collaborating and they're sharing research and they're, like, we're learning things about safety and they're learning things about safety. And we're, you know, we're negotiating, you know. My grandfather, Paul Nitze, arms negotiator, negotiated with the Soviet Union, you come up with some deals. And if the United States like views China as an all-out enemy, that if they get to that line, they will control the world and make the world fascist or make the world communist, I don't think that is as likely to lead us to a good place as if we recognize that in some areas they're an economic adversary, and in some cases our interests diverge sharply, right, including leadership of Taiwan and all kinds of things. And they do spy on us, and they do, you know, steal our trade secrets, and they do make it hard for companies, and they do block American tech companies from operating there. But there are lots of ways that we could be collaborating with them. And I also think that there's a case you can make that our policies toward China have been even counterproductive, right? So we've banned them from buying certain NVIDIA chips, right? The policy shifts a bunch of time. But like, it would be a lot better if China had NVIDIA chips, both because NVIDIA would get more money because it would sell more chips. And then also, if there is a situation of conflict, there's a little bit of leverage because all of China would be running on NVIDIA chips, right? If China's running on Huawei chips, A, there's no money going to NVIDIA. And B, if there's a situation of conflict, well, you'd rather there be interdependence as opposed to independence. So I feel like the argument made by the tech industry about China is not one that is healthy for the world as a whole, and even probably for the United States.
You're not scared if we have AI with them, they're going to have backdoors and look at our things and program our children.
Well, I mean, sure, there's like, you know, and I don't use DeepSeek because I don't trust it, right? And I don't trust that it's not going to, you know, tunnel into my system and send that stuff to, like, so yes, I'm a realist about that. But I don't think there's this dichotomous race.
Right. And I don't either. And Russia's not even in it in that sense.
Russia's they're in a totally different world. I mean, they're busy, you know, bombing Ukrainian schools, right, instead of like building AI.
Yeah.
But that is one issue where my view most differs probably from the general political consensus of Washington. So, and you asked about AI, media, and China. Yeah. I don't know whether there's
media,
there's not really a
big connection. Really mean media so much. It was just that sort of that geopolitical element of it. The only part that feels is geopolitical is the China element and then the elements themselves. Where do we get the stuff to make this? You know?
Right. And that's an interesting, like, I believe in free trade. I believe that, you know, the world is a much better place. It's not a better place if the U.S., like, has to mine its minerals because it can't trade with anybody else and get our minerals because, A, you're then highly dependent and you have to pay taxes and it's inefficient. And, you know, I believe that a better world is one in which there are relatively few barriers between countries and you can make trades and deals and you can protect U.S. industries and you have, you know, environmental regulations and it's complicated. But I do think in general an atomized world where it's every country for themselves is worse than a world where they're more international dependencies. I think it's a safer world. I think it's a more prosperous world. I think it's a better world.
Right. And it's not a particularly Trumpian world.
It's a very un-Trumpian world.
Right. Which brings me to the last question, which really kind of should have been the first. The story, where were you when, or I guess he told you before, did Goldberg tell Jay Goldberg?
Jeff Goldberg, yeah.
Did he tell you before he told anyone else that he was on the tweet about making, or no, not the tweet, the signal
chat.
That he was stuck in the signal chat about launching the war?
I can't go into exactly when he told me, but it wasn't, I knew he had a big story. I knew there were things we have to do because I'm in charge of the legal team and I'm in charge of the cybersecurity team and I'm, you know, you have to make preparations, but I didn't know what the story was.
Really?
Yeah.
Because when a guy like that discovers that he's in the signal chat with the head of whatever's.
We have total separation. I mean, he and I talk all the time. We have a great relationship.
But what's he supposed to, if I were a journalist, all right, working for The Atlantic, and I was on that signal thing, who do I call?
So you call the lawyer, right?
My own lawyer or the company.
The Atlantic's lawyer. We have great general counsel, right? And you tell me and you tell Loreen that you have a big story and there's a security risk and that we should be prepared for it. And then we tell you, great, you publish whatever you want and we don't care. We're not going to worry about the effect on the business. You make all those judgments. And then you tell your editor. And, you know, he co-bylined a second piece with Shane Harris, who's a great investigative intelligence reporter. And so you tell people like that and you work with people like that on the editorial side.
So do you ever fear, like, America getting to a place where you personally would be like in danger of like black copters? And
I mean, this government's treatment of the press has not been great, right? And there have been raids on journalists, and there have been FBI investigations into journalists, and there have been a lot of dark signs. But I don't fear either of the two bad outcomes, one which is the government would come after me. I don't see that as likely. And I can't imagine a situation where our owner would say you have to change the way you behave to make the government happy, right? Which is what is the real risk that has happened at so many other publications,
right?
Where you have to change the business, you have to change the editorial to please the government, right? Because the government has some leverage point on your owner, and the government has said, hey, you know, if you make me mad with my stories, I'll get rid of this other thing that's more valuable to you than this publication. And our owner would never do that. And
right.
So I don't have either of those two fears. Now, that's not to say I'm not an idiot. Like, we have mapped out, if the government were to say, you know, we're going to maximally go after the Atlantic,
right,
what would they do? And if we know what those steps are, what would we do in response? Okay, so then how do we prepare ourselves for those eventualities? And so we have certainly worked through that. But the court system in this country has mostly held, right? You know, Trump says a lot of mean things about the press. He also gives a lot of interviews to The Atlantic.
Right.
He calls our reporters at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I know, he calls your reporters, but they're suing you again for something, right? Didn't they do another one now?
The Cash Patel is
right.
suing us over our reporting on him, yeah.
Of his drinking or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So there's a lot to worry about, but we prepare. We trust our ownership.
I know. It's not like you're not like Maria Ressa getting, you know, thrown into jail by Duterte or something. It's not.
No, there would have to be a massive escalation. And remember, right after Signalgate, you know, so Signalgate comes out. Goldberg publishes a story. Government does this very weird thing. Like, normally when you publish a story, the government denies it at first and then eventually comes to admit it, right? That's how the process works, right? Eventually they deny it and they like pretend, they try to test and see whether you have the cards. When they realize you have the cards, they confirm it. In this case, they did it in reverse. They confirmed it because obviously we had the cards.
Right.
And then they weirdly denied it. Like, Pete Hegseth comes off the plane and says this is false. And so we were in a very strange loop with them. And so we go through that loop. Jeff publishes his second story where if you're going to say we don't have it,
right,
we'll just, here it is, right?
Right?
Judge for yourself, right? And then the next thing that happens after that is that Jeff and Ashley and Michael Scherer go and interview the president, right? It wasn't that like the president said, you know, send out his, you know.
So they get access as a result, which is the opposite of the Chomsky model that in theory you would lose access once you've done that.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that there have been ways I'm not as deep in the edit, like,
yeah,
probably stories where we haven't been called back. And, you know, they did say a lot of mean things about us on Twitter. But what was also interesting about those days is, you know, if it had been a story where, like, put 100 people in a room and say, who's right, The Atlantic or the government? And it had been like a 65-35 story. And like,
yeah,
really partisan Republicans could kind of squint and believe that, or really partisan Trump supporters could squint and believe that Trump was right. That's a different scenario. But if you looked at Twitter in those days, it was 99-1, because you had to be fully in the tank and fully deluded to not think that we had the goods, right? We clearly did. And like, obviously, they shouldn't have been sharing that stuff on Signal. Like,
right.
It was like, no American was like, oh yeah, it's good for like to like share your war plans, like just like send them around the crowd on your personal device. Like, no one thought that was good. And so you watch that dynamic, and it was in somewhat cheering that, like, presented with the evidence and presented with reality, all of social media was on our side. I mean, there are a few people who like would say, oh, The Atlantic's a failing publication, they're going out of business, don't trust them, but no one could say we weren't right there.
Right. I mean, I sometimes feel like part of the reason why Trump wouldn't go after you is he's in the kayfabe wrestling game. You're the other side. He's depending on you.
His relationship to the media is very complicated. And it's not, you know, he does say all kinds of mean things to reporters, and he is trying to like decrease the trust. And he and Elon Musk have been quite successful in, you know, turning a lot of America against the media. But he also does love the media too.
Right. Are you concerned about like the the funding of the more sort of anti-journalist stuff. I'm like, I'm reading stories, you know, Peter Thiel and others kind of what, you know, I mean, it was back when he, what he did to Gawker, but the sort of the more modern effort at kind of publicizing and kind of promoting the, you know, public disdain of Definitely. Journalists they don't like.
Yeah, that's a real risk. And there's a real risk of being, there are a couple of risks that we have and all, you know, all publications that try to report truth about powerful people face. One, of course, is you're being set up, right? And you can imagine someone sending a fake story to The Atlantic and saying, you know, hey, check this out, in a way to try to discredit us so that right. people wouldn't trust our accurate reporting, right? You know, you can imagine this becomes harder and harder in a world of deep fakes and AI, right? You can imagine all kinds of risks. And so right. we need to be trained in those risks, right? You have to be, you know, you can also imagine, you know, hacks and other forms of manipulation. Like they are going to try to discredit us. And you just have to do your best against that and be prepared for when it happens. And there are people on social media who will take made up stories and fake headlines and share them and say, The Atlantic published this. You'll never believe The Atlantic shared a story saying this. And then we have to try to find the source and try to push back and see what you can do. We live in that reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that reality is only going to get harder because you're not going to know who's real and who's not real on social media.
I know. That's why I don't do it. And that's why I still, but I'm a different world. I still want, I want my Atlantic.
Good.
But I want my New Republic. I want my Harper's. I want my Utney Reader. I mean, I want them all. So you've got to move. You got to move to other publications.
It's a little, it's an interesting question about the, I don't know the business of any of those publications well enough to know why the hard moments came when the hard moments came.
Yeah. Well, and The Atlantic has that whole other thing though. They've got the sort of the Walter Isaacson Aspen Institute events, you know, they're yeah. plugged in a way, which makes me not worry for them.
What I want. Right. And my job is to make it so that people like you want to write stories that we will pay you for.
Right.
And so I need to build a business model so that we can make money off of that story that you publish. Right. And the reason why print stories used to get so much more money than digital stories is because they were attached to subscriptions. They were attached to print advertising. Well, print advertising has gone way down and subscriptions digitally have gone way up. Right. So what is the value of you doing a print story versus doing a digital story for me? They've converged,
yeah. right?
And so have the economics converged? Not entirely, but they've started converging. And so, you know, I do think that era of media economics where you would get $2 a word to write for print and 10 cents a word to write for digital, I don't think that's a yeah. real world anymore.
No, although what has changed a little bit, and I don't know if it's true at The Atlantic, most places where I'm asked to write is so that I will bring eyeballs to the magazine. I want to go to a magazine, so the magazine brings eyeballs right. to my story. Well, and so that's something like The Atlantic has that well, it, that, you know, I mean, that Joe's magazine
like,
doesn't.
I don't want to like, this is like no. a small point for the yeah. end of an interview, but this is like one of the most important things for any publication that exists today is to be able to provide real value, whether it's editing, distribution, fact-checking, legal support, to any writer who has their own audience. Because if you can't do that, they're all going to go to Substack, right? So we need to provide more value, not just to you as a freelancer, but to every one of our staff writers.
Right.
Because if we're not providing that, and if our social media feeds aren't tweeting out your story well, and we're not putting it on Facebook, and we're not driving an audience, and we're not giving you legal right. support, and we're not giving you fact-checking, and we're not making it look beautiful, and we're putting the wrong headline on, you're going to leave. And there's a lot of options for you to go to. So one of our jobs is not just to pay you well and then to monetize the story so we can justify that payment mm-hmm. is to support you.
Well, thank you. You yeah. can support us. And you can support us too by going to patreon.com/teamhuman and becoming a supporting member of the team. We'll love you forever. You can also, you know, if you've got a company or a thing or a big magazine, you can advertise on Team Human. I'll speak it directly to camera. And instead of me saying this to you now, I'll be speaking about your company or project or organization to everybody. We've been here with Nicholas Thompson, now president of The Atlantic. I just love to say that. It's just like, isn't that president of The Atlantic? It could mean anything. I mean, we know what it means, but The Atlantic. It's the ocean. Remember Trump Ocean? It used to be called The Atlantic Ocean. And back then, there was this magazine called The Atlantic. All right, thanks for being on Team Human.
Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin, edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.